What is up, everybody? I know we have been gone for quite some time. I think this is a month now that we haven't posted a podcast on Voices. There's some background to that, so I guess I'll go ahead and get into that. If you haven't noticed already, there's no Katie, unfortunately. Katie, right around, I guess it was about a month ago, school started back up, and I think both Katie and I underestimated how tough it was going to be to do a research podcast and still maintain the rest of our everyday lives and try to fit in all that research and writing and reading and all that good stuff. Katie's a stay-at-home mom. She's got a wonderful little year and a half old already, I guess. Dang. And also her 10-year-old, soon to be 11-year-old son, who is doing e-learning, and she needed to take some time and focus on that and get all that stuff. The podcast absolutely was her second, not even her second. It was a lower priority than her children and her family life and all that. And I 100% understand that. It is hard for me as well to try to do all this stuff. It wasn't easy trying to fit in all the research and all that stuff in the podcast. And Katie decided she needed a break, and that's 100% okay. So Katie decided she needed to take a break from things, and I 100% understand that. So we had recorded the part one of a story I was going to try to tell. And we were just having a lot of issues, a lot of noise issues, a lot of microphone issues. Just all kinds of stuff was weird in that recording. It would have been really hard to edit. And we probably only would have got like 20 minutes of actual content out of it. And then right after that is when Katie told me she needed to step away. So part of the reason I've been gone so long trying to do this, I'm going to try to do it myself, try to do some solos, see how it works out. Probably maybe eventually bring somebody in just to have some sort of kind of back and forth, a little bit of banter maybe, and we'll see how that goes. Just kind of experiment for a little bit and see if Katie ever wants to come back, and we'll give her some time. And I mean, I would love to have her back. She's my co-host. She's my sister. I love her. So yeah, we're just going to give her time, and we're just going to see how we can make this work without it. But I tried to re-record that part one that I was going to put out by myself, and it was awkward, super awkward. It was just, it's a whole different vibe trying to sit down here and talk to you guys by myself without anybody around. So yeah, it was just bad. It was awful. It was awkward, and it was just bad. So I didn't put it out. I think I ended up deleting the whole thing. I wasn't proud of it. You guys wouldn't definitely not have listened to it. It's just been a busy time, and it was hard trying to get the feel for a solo podcast, story-based podcast or whatever. So instead of releasing that crappy podcast, I just tried to find something that I could maybe get into in the zone with, feel comfortable with, and just try to and maybe relax, get the feel for this solo thing. So I'm going to tell you today about the first story I can remember that got me into true crime and probably kicked off my obsession with true crime and serial killers. Majority of what I listen to and shows I watch and all that are true crime based type of deal. And this book, and I think I can go ahead and say thanks to my mom for getting me on this journey. My mom was very big into the horror movies and all that stuff. And this book, the book that I read that kicked this off, was actually her book, and I found it when I was in like junior high, I think, and read about it. Well, I read it and learned about the story. So I'm going to tell you about the 1983 murders of the Hendrix family in Bloomington, Illinois. So there was a book published, I think it was published in 1989. It's called Reasonable Doubt. And that's the book I read as a young child. Since then, it's gotten two extra chapters written into it. So while doing the research, I reread that. Well, I got it on audiobook and listened to it. It's a 17-hour book, so it took me a while to get through. But it's packed with details. All right, let's jump into it. Okay, so this story is based off David Hendrix, his wife Susan, and their children. Now, David was born in Morton Grove, but was raised in Oak Park, Illinois. He was a member of the exclusive branch of the Plymouth Brethren, which is a conservative Christian denomination. It's not necessarily a church as much as it is a like meeting. It's weird. They don't have necessarily a church, but they have meetups and groups. It's kind of confusing, but or maybe to me, maybe not to you guys. And David met his wife Susan through a gathering held at Susan's parents' house when David was 15 years old. At first, Susan didn't pay much attention to David until Susan ended up spending a summer interning in northern Illinois, where she stayed with David's family. So after some time living in the same house, David had finally caught her eye. He would write her poems and stuff like that, and she finally got sucked in. David finally got a hold of her. After that, they quickly got engaged and planned to wed as soon as David, who was a year younger than Susan, could support them financially. David became a very successful businessman and eventually invented a new back brace. The brace was a major success, and within a few months, the brace couldn't get manufactured fast enough to fulfill the orders. He eventually sold his ortho business to focus solely on this new brace. And he and Susan eventually had their three children, Rebecca, who was 9, Grace, who was 7, and Benjamin, who was 5. All right, now we're going to skip forward to November of 1983. The family was living at 313 Carl Drive in Bloomington, Illinois. Susan had a baby shower to go to one evening, so it was just David and the kids. David took his children to Eastland Mall, where I went many times. Hundreds of times probably growing up, and now that I live back in Illinois, I still go there frequently. Not so much these days as Corona doesn't let anybody go anywhere. But anyway, some school art was on display at the mall, and their daughter Rebecca had won an award, so they went to the mall to see it. And after that, they went to Chuck E. Cheese, where they ate some pizza, and the kids got to run around and play on the jungle gym. Play games, all the things you do at Chuck E. Cheese. David found them a seat in the back where it was quiet and had a TV. He sat back there and watched TV and would come out periodically to watch the kids play. Eventually it was time to go. David rounded up his children. David was afraid that they were going to miss the library's bookmobile, which was basically just a library on wheels. It posted up in the neighborhood, and all the children were able to go and check out books. So in fear of missing out on not being able to get new books, the family raced home. David pulled into the driveway, and Rebecca, the oldest daughter, ran inside and grabbed the books and headed back outside. They headed down the block to the bookmobile when David actually realized the bookmobile didn't leave for another 15 minutes. There was no reason to rush, but they actually had plenty of time to look at books, return books, and their youngest Benjamin was getting his first library card. They returned home, where they settled down, and the children went to bed. Susan returned home around 10:30, and David left the house around 11 p.m. that night to set off for a business trip to Wisconsin. The next day, David had tried to get a hold of his wife on a few occasions, but was never successful. He wasn't immediately worried, but he did say it was kind of odd because Susan was always on time. If she said she was going to be somewhere, then she was there. So he wasn't worried, but he felt odd about it. On November 7th, 1983, Susan and the kids were supposed to go to family dinner, but they never showed. The family and David shared many phone calls back and forth that day, trying to figure out where Susan and the kids could be. David, now getting worried, called the Bloomington police to see if an officer could go to his house and check on his family. Shortly after that, Susan's mother returned home from the family dinner and called police as well to see if they could check the children's school attendance to see if they had been at school that day. Now, the police officer that Susan's mom talked to said it was too late to have the principal go to school and check the records, but the officer ended up forwarding her call to someone that could help, and eventually an officer was dispatched to the Hendricks house. When the officer got on scene, he was met there by a veteran detective who had overheard the dispatch call, and also by Susan's brother and brother-in-law, who had headed over to check on their sister after leaving the family's dinner. The officers, sensing something was off, asked the brothers to stay outside while they checked the house, and it was a good thing they did. The officers went inside, they checked downstairs, and noticed the house looked out of order. They moved upstairs and were met with a grisly scene. One of the officers moved into the bedroom, being careful not to shine his flashlight in the face of anyone who may be sleeping. Shining his light on the foot of the bed, that's when he saw it, the first sign of blood. He moved the beam of light from his flashlight up to the head of the bed, blood becoming more and more apparent as he traveled up the mattress. That's when he saw the dark hair of a young girl. He quickly moved his light to the other bed in the room where he found the two bodies of the other children, also covered in blood. The officer called out to his partner to let him know they had a problem. The detective came down to see the horrific sight and let the officer know what he had found in the other room. Susan, dead in her bed. After a few minutes, the officer came back outside to the brothers, who were still waiting. After a moment of silence, one of the brothers asked if everything was okay, and the officers had to tell them what they had found. The whole family brutally murdered in their beds. An axe and a butcher's knife were found at the scene, clean, almost to pristine condition. Police instantly thought the scene was suspicious because there was no sign of forced entry and little sign of struggle. We also came to the conclusion that the house was staged. When the officers first entered the house, they thought it was odd. They had some drawers and stuff were open in the kitchen and rooms and all that, and it just didn't seem like an actual burglary was going on. The officers suspected it was staged almost immediately. And of course, because Hendricks was the only surviving member of the family, he became their primary suspect. And because of his relationship to the family, he was bound to be a suspect anyway. But police had an even higher suspicion because of the way they found the scene. The murders were just horrible, as you can imagine. All three children and David's wife were hacked to death with a fucking axe and a butcher's knife. These poor people were brutally murdered. And the axe and butcher's knife were found, like I said, in a pristine condition on one of the beds that the children was in, just on the foot of the bed. Because there was two weapons, it led some people to believe that there may have been two killers. So David, who had already left Wisconsin because he was worried something was going on after his family and couldn't get a hold of him, and both him and his mother-in-law called police, he left Wisconsin and was on his way home. He returned home just after 11 p.m. the night the bodies were found, and he was met by his brothers, who obviously thought it would be better for David to hear from them the news about the murders instead of from a random stranger, the officers on scene. Now, there are two different recollections of how David responded to the news. We'll get to the brothers first. The brothers walked towards David, who had to park down the road because the police had blocked off the scene. David, according to the brothers, said, "What's wrong? Something's wrong." He was told his family was gone and they were now with the Lord. David asked, "What do you mean?" And they responded with, "They're dead. They've been murdered." Now, the brothers say that David's knees seemed to buckle and he let out an animal-like groan. But the officer and deputy coroner don't remember it quite that way. First off, Officer O'Brien was surprised David had returned so soon. He knew he was traveling back, but was not expecting him to be there that early. He made a mental note to check how hot the car engine was, because he was already suspicious of David. Now, Officer O'Brien was only a few feet away when the brothers told David the news. He wanted to be the one to tell David, but he definitely needed to be around to see how he responded. He saw the brothers take David by the arms, but didn't hear any words. Nobody was talking. O'Brien approached David as if he was Mr. Hendricks and explained to him that his family had been murdered. Officer O'Brien remembers David's head dropping as he let out an, "Oh no, did they suffer?" The officer told David it was a violent scene, but David only said, "They're with the Lord now." This is not how Officer O'Brien expected him to respond. And reading the book, it was like, it just seemed very convenient to me that he waited the whole, it was like a whole 2 or 3 days. He waited until right before he was leaving to head back into town from Wisconsin to call the police. I don't know. It just seemed very odd to me. Anyway, David was immediately questioned, and police checked his clothes and car for blood. And they didn't find anything during their search, and his alibi of being out of state seemed to hold up. And I guess we never know how someone's going to react and during the time of crisis and being put in that position. But at the same time, I can't even think about not having my daughter in my life without getting teary-eyed. So to remain calm as the officers remembered David being calm, I would be an absolute mess finding out that not only one child, three children, and my wife had died. I would be a blubbering fool. But even though his alibi seemed strong, the police had no other leads. So they went with what they had, and they looked into David's story more closely. During the autopsy of the children, pizza toppings were found in all three of their stomachs. This is actually a huge part of the trial, and they spent many hours and days disputing whether pizza would still be in the stomachs or not at the time of death, and how that could be pinned on David being the actual murderer. And what they were saying was, ordinarily food leaves the stomach and moves the small intestine within 2 hours. And because of this, investigators determined their time of death was closer to 9:30 on the 4th. And because of this, investigators determined their time of death was closer to 9:30 on the night of November 4th. It was about the time he said the children went to bed. Hendricks was still home at 9:30. This is why that's such a big deal. So police didn't find any signs of forced entry. David told reporters that burglars had broke in. Now, there were things missing, but David was never told that things were missing, and he was never granted access to the house when he returned home. So if he wasn't allowed in the house, nobody told him that things were missing. How did he know certain things were missing? It only took 4 days for police to arrest David and bring him in. He was charged with the murder of all four members of his family, even though they didn't have a concrete motive. Now, during his trial, the prosecution claimed that he was living a double life, that he was materialistic, selfish, and was in contact with other women despite his faith. And many models came forward during the trial. Some said he didn't make any advances to them or touch them inappropriately, while many, many others said that he had, in fact, touched them inappropriately. And it was made abundantly clear that every time he came into contact with a model, a new model, he was escalating his behavior, leading up to the fondling of multiple women's breasts, inappropriate hugging, and trying to kiss at least one model. Almost all of these models were asked to strip down to their bra and panties. Not a big fan of the word panties, but that's the word they use in the book, so I'll use it. And then many were even asked to take off their bras. Like, huh? Just to fit a back brace? You gotta be naked? But then you wear the brace over your clothes. Sounds sketchy, Dave. And during the trial, another ortho was questioned who fitted the exact same brace. He never had any of his patients take off their clothing, unless it was a bulky item like a sweater or sweatshirt. and definitely not in their bra and panties, let alone naked. And some say it was David's desire to continue his life, continue the life he was leading. And divorce wasn't an option because of his religion. So, of course, the reasonable answer was to murder his fucking wife and children. Get the fuck out of here. Reasonable response. I don't understand people. All right, so the murder trial went on way longer than it was expected to. And the book goes into deep, deep detail of the harassment of the models and his escalating behavior. It goes really, really deep into the findings of the pizza in the children's stomachs, which is, it's all insanely interesting. And it's very interesting to me, but I'll let you guys get into the book and read it if you want to. The trial is super detailed in the book. If I went into every single detail, this would probably be like a 3 or 4 part podcast. And I'm already like pretty deep on my pages of notes here. So get the book if you're interested in all the crazy details of the models and the back and forth on the stomach contents. But I just wanted to pick apart the meat and potatoes and really get into the story. Okay, so we will get into the models a little bit. The models themselves had very detailed testimony on what happened to them and their presence of David. And when David was questioned about everything the model said, he didn't deny any of it. He came clean. The only thing he disputed were like minor things. Like one model said that he had many affairs on his wife. He said, no, I would have never said that. It was just like very small things. He didn't deny any of the touching, any of the groping, any of the advances. Just small little phrases and words and things that he said he never would have said or he didn't remember saying. So in my opinion, all David did during his time on the stand was enforce the idea that he was trying to cheat on his wife, and that could have very well led the jury to the idea that he killed his wife and children to continue this illustrious life that with these models that he was living the double life, and that was the prosecution's point. So you're leading the jury yourself to the motive of you killing your wife and children. It was just his way of getting out of his marriage without being shamed by his peers and the brethren. And he didn't want to get kicked out of the brethren. And a lot of the trial was based on his stomach contents. He went back and forth and back and forth. And then they would move to something else. And it would always come back to the stomach content. But it was kind of like neither side could say that this was for sure a good estimate of time of death, or it was not a good estimate of time of death. It was a mess. So the whole trial was based off the stomach contents, the models, and a little bit of David's recollection of the night he left for the trip and the couple of days after he returned home. So I'm going to skip all the way down to the closing arguments. The prosecution brought up the fact that David had lied about his license plate number when he checked into the hotel in Wisconsin. He gave a fake license plate number, and during his testimony, he said he couldn't remember if it was an old license plate number or if it was just something he made up. But he said he had been doing it regularly, and he did it for fun. And they brought up that David lied about not having his back brace to a medical technician on his trip when he, in fact, did have his back brace, and to another technician that he was on an extended vacation. It was also brought up that David was expecting his family to be at relatives for dinner at 5:30. So why was David calling home to reach them? The prosecution was saying this was all a setup, him calling his family and friends and neighbors to set up a scene, to have people knock on the door and get no response. His call to the police suspecting they got in an accident on the way to dinner. But when he was told there were no reported accidents, he was so worried he left the hotel he was staying at and stated and told them that he was leaving early because there had been an emergency, yet testified that when he stopped at the service station en route home, he didn't think there was a problem. It's just all very weird. The prosecution claims that the reason David made all these phone calls was to find out if anyone had discovered what he had already knew. He was trying to see if anybody had found the bodies. It was also brought up that this was the only time on record that David left at night to set out for a business trip. And here's a bit of evidence that really kind of stuck with me. And in many statements, David told the detective he left at midnight. And now he testified under oath that he left at 11 p.m. David said on the trip to Wisconsin, he made 3 15-minute stops, ending at a Hardee's at his destination, Wisconsin. And the total drive time was 5 hours and 45 minutes. With those 3 15-minute stops, that's a total commute time of 6 hours and 30 minutes. His receipt that was put into evidence had a timestamp of 7:17 a.m., the receipt from Hardee's. Now, simple subtraction shows that David, having reached Hardee's at 7:17 a.m., wouldn't have left his house till about 12:45 a.m., which is plenty of time. And no matter how you take it, his testimony or his word under oath, the times don't line up, which, and it gives him plenty of time to commit these murders. It shows that he had opportunity to commit these crimes. All right. The prosecution also brought up the fact that David didn't have any appointments for the following day. So why did he have to leave? He had to leave so late. Why? If he didn't have any appointments, then he didn't have to leave until the morning. Now, salespeople make cold calls and go to businesses blindly. And David did just that when he was in Wisconsin. But if he didn't have any definite appointments and wasn't held to a schedule, why did he have to leave so late at night? And finally, the jury was also reminded that David's first questioning by police, he was questioned if he locked the doors when he left. And maybe not so coincidentally, the first door David brought up and during that questioning was the back patio door. The very door that was unlocked and the door the officers used to gain entry of the house the night they discovered the bodies. The prosecution had basically was trying to prove the point that it could have been no one but David because of the lack of evidence, the manner the house was found in, how the house was a stage robbery, and the extramarital affairs and the unnecessary late night business trip all pointed to David. Now, the weight of the pizza was also brought up, claiming that David only had one piece and the children ate the rest of it, which was 9 pieces. So let me break this down for you through my eyes. David has one piece of pizza. The children are left with 9. There's 3 kids. It's 3 pieces of pizza themselves. Now, if any of you have been to Chuck E. Cheese, the pizzas there aren't very big. So it was just brought up that the kids couldn't eat that much pizza and blah, blah, blah. Like, they're children. They're playing around at Chuck E. Cheese. They're running around. They're playing all day long. The kids have crazy appetites. Mine does. She eats all day. I always do what David did when it came to the pizza. You take your dad tax. You eat a bite or a piece of your child's food, and then you just let them finish it. And if there's anything left over, you get to finish that too. I do it all the time to Addie. Addie will get a pizza, and I'll eat one of her slices of cheese pizza. And then she's got the whole pizza to herself. In my 10 slices for 4 people, my initial reaction was like, oh man, that's not a lot of pizza. That's like 2 slices each, maybe. So the argument about how much they ate, I'm just not here for it. It was a weird argument. I don't know any kid who can't eat 3 little small slices of pizza. And it's not, I don't find it odd that David only ate one, because like I put myself in that position. I eat one, I let my kids eat until they're full. And then if there's some left over, I'll finish it. If not, I'll eat when I get home. Honestly, I would have bought probably 2 pizzas to begin with, so I didn't have to eat when I got home and everybody could eat, but that it is what it is. Okay. So the defense, when it was their turn to speak, they really didn't have a whole lot to say. They claimed the prosecution proved that David could have murdered his family, but they did not prove that he actually did murder his family. The defense attorney stated that almost all the questions he was hit with were rhetorical, like, why did David lose weight? Because he was fat or because he was a murderer? Why did he get a haircut? Because he had a coupon for a free haircut or because it fit in the state's theory of murder? Why did he buy new suits? Because he was going on a business trip or because it fit in a theory that he was living a dual lifestyle? And I think you get the point with that. The defense attorney said he was so upset by this because he didn't feel like he had been a part of an actual trial, but more like a play. The state had came to their conclusion and written an entire play supporting their conclusion, not looking at actual evidence or lack thereof. The defense then goes on to basically throw all the models' testimonies out the window, claiming they were only there because it backed up the story the state was trying to tell, and that one model did not show, possibly because it didn't fit the story. Okay, now that got to me. That one angered me. How about maybe the women that showed up were brave enough to fucking be there and tell their story and face the man that abused them, and the one who didn't show up maybe just couldn't quite get to that point where she could face the man that abused her. It was like saying these women who don't show up to court or speak up about their abuse just don't care to do it. Not that they're suffering from what happened. Not that they're suffering from what happened to them and they can't bring themselves to be in the same room as the person who fucked them up. Like, fuck off, dude. Like, that really angered me. The defense can... Oh, yeah. Oof. The defense can shove that one. I'm sorry. Going too far. It just really pissed me off that he was like, oh, and she didn't show up because she would tell a different story. No, there's probably plenty of reasons why she didn't actually show up and tell her story. All right. Woosah. The defense was also claiming that David had already killed the children before Susan returned home, which is feasible, but that she, when she came home, she had a cup of tea and she goes to bed with David and eventually falls asleep. Never checking on her kids, doesn't kiss them goodnight, nothing. She doesn't detect any sign of something that went wrong or something horrible happened. And then David kills her while she's asleep. And it just, like, it was just a random thing. Like, it just, I don't know. It was just, to me, it was like, well, now you're trying to tell a story and make things fit. And that's what you just claimed the prosecution was doing because you didn't play out any other theories. I mean, it's very possible that the kids were still asleep when Susan returned home at 10:30. And then when she fell asleep, David could have then murdered the whole family. It didn't have to be in two separate occasions. Anyway, now the defense tries to turn it in a way that they're saying the prosecution is saying David's life was too good to be true, that no one has that many good things going for them, a great family life, he's a good man, he's very into his religion, he's seen as a great man by his peers, blah, blah, blah. Basically saying that they were jealous of David, claiming they're envious because they got mad at their families, or that they couldn't devote that much time to their faith, or they couldn't be as successful as David, as young as David was. The defense closed their statements. The defense didn't seem like they had much to go on. And they closed their statements by rehashing the play bit, saying that if you took everything into account, you'd see, like he explained, the state came to a conclusion and built a show based off the closing scene. And if they thought independently, they would see they had just been wrapped up in this show, and that they didn't think David was capable of committing this heinous murder to his own family, except for in a made-up story. After again touching on the contents of the stomach, I'm telling you guys, it's like one of the only things they had, I feel like. They brought up the theory that because the house wasn't ransacked doesn't necessarily mean that the robbery was staged. The defense also states that only 35 minutes after David's first questioning, the questioning officer had already made up his mind that David was guilty. And he goes on to state that this theory revolves around the fact that he was guilty. So he made the evidence back up his theory. Now they wrap by stating all the evidence against David was circumstantial, and you can't prove a person to be guilty on circumstantial evidence. Now the prosecution got their chance to rebuttal, and they said that they said there wasn't an eyewitness or one thing that they could point to, but that doesn't mean circumstantial evidence isn't evidence. He claims they proved that the defendant had an opportunity to commit the crime, and not only did he have an opportunity, he had the exclusive opportunity because the children were killed when he was still home. They brought up the fact that the defense claimed this was all just a made-up story and claimed that everyone involved did their due diligence when handling this case and that they didn't make the evidence fit. However, all the evidence turned back to David naturally. And what was proven with the models was that David was not done with them. Had he shown regret or remorse about anything, maybe it would be a different story, but he didn't. He admitted to everything and even admitted to taking things further had he not been in the position he was in right now. The evidence shows that his behavior was only escalating and that the worst encounter with the model happened right before the murders. This lust is what had given David the motive to kill his family. Finally, when everything was turned over to the jury, after 5.5 hours of deliberation, the jury reached their verdict. At around 10:30 p.m., November 28th, 64 days after the jurors had been seated, 1 year, 20 days after the murders of David Hendricks' family, he was found guilty on all 4 counts of murder. David Hendricks waived his right of trial by jury. The sentencing trial was set to start in 3 weeks. 3 weeks later, at the sentencing hearing, the judge read the verdict. He stated that because he had not been convinced beyond reasonable doubt that David committed the murders, the death penalty was off the table, but the public needed to be protected for Mr. Hendricks. David Hendricks was sentenced to life in prison without the right or availability of mandatory supervised release, parole, or other forms of early release. And David was fined $44,000 and ordered to pay the cost of the trial and placed a lien on all property owned by David as of the day he was indicted. Then, on September 29th, 1989, the Illinois Supreme Court decided to take a second look at David's case. Shortly before this hearing began, the media got their hands on a report that David Hendricks had directly accused his ex-brother-in-law, John Lewis, of committing the murders. Hendricks claimed John had never felt accepted by his sister Susan and hated the members of the Brethren. He was jealous that he and Susan were successful and that John was not, and that John had forbidden his wife to attend a meeting of the Brethren. But the Sunday before the murders, Susan had taken her sister to a Brethren meeting. David claimed John was in possession of a key to his house because John and his wife had watched the children one weekend while they were away. Now, John threw away the key 1 week after the murders were committed. Is it coincidence? Is it not? He had a key. He got rid of it when he didn't need it anymore. Sketchy, but David's team brought up that there was once physical evidence that John could have committed the murders. Shortly after the murders, John brought home a pair of surgical scrubs covered with blood splatter on them and asked his wife to wash them. When asked about them, John claimed he got them from a doctor, but that doctor denies ever giving John a pair of scrubs, and the doctor didn't even work at the hospital the scrubs were from until months after John came home with the scrubs. So, when John was confronted about this, he refused to talk further. He shut down completely. Now, after the murder, John's wife had claimed he had been home all night with her, but since then, her marriage to John had ended, and her story changed. She says John had left around 10 p.m. the night of the murders, saying he was going to lift weights. And she described her ex-husband as mentally unstable. John said he was dumbfounded when David accused him and said all the allegations from his ex-wife came out of bitterness. At this hearing, David's attorney acknowledged that the jury found David guilty on all 4 counts, but the judge stated he had not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Thus, showing the judge was able to see through the circumstantial evidence and base his sentencing off what was actually proven. Had the jury done that, David would have never been convicted. And on July 3rd, 1990, Hendricks' conviction and life sentence was overturned. Hendricks would not immediately be released, but would be tried a second time. During David's retrial, a man who had served time with stepped forward with some shocking news. Danny Wayne Stark, serving 33 years for theft in Indiana, was about to drop a bomb on David Hendricks. Stark says David told him he thought his family was murdered by a serial killer and asked Stark's input on how he could win his case. Hendricks confided that he had some girlfriends, but discarded the idea that one of them had something to do with the murders. And finally, Stark says he had to admit it. He had to tell me what he did so I could help him figure out someone to push it off on. Stark says David said no one saw him do it, and a lot of it had to do with his family. He was running around on his wife, and his wife became suspicious and began to threaten him with it. David was worried his father would find out. He said he got married too early, came into money, and was stuck with a plain woman. Yeah, that's what he called his wife. Now, I think at this point, I don't know if we could say David did or did not murder his family, but I think we can all agree that David Hendricks was a big piece of shit. Stark claimed that David told him on the night of the murders he drove his car to the airport, where he had his motorcycle stored, and drove that back to his house. He got an axe from his garage and a butcher knife from the kitchen and proceeded to kill his wife and children, claiming he knocked them out with the axe and then used the butcher knife to kill him. Stark claims David said killing his son was the hardest thing he ever had to do. David told him he washed the knife in the bathroom. However, three other inmates that David had been around were called for their testimony, and they all stated David had always maintained his innocence, and all three of these men claimed Stark was not an honest man. Then, David's younger brother took the stand, claiming he flew to San Francisco 3 weeks earlier to confront John Lewis himself. And while there, John admitted to the murder, saying, "I hacked up his family," and also said he denied ever saying it. No one was there to witness this conversation. On March 28, 1991, David Hendricks was found not guilty on all four counts. This man is free. He's free. There's no proof that anybody else murdered his family. There's only circumstantial evidence that he did, but this man is free. Here's the thing. Murdered his family or not, he shouldn't be free. He was freaking abusing these models. He was taking advantage of these models. That's abuse, right? He should be at least served a longer sentence for that. I don't know. Anyway, as of today, David Hendricks has rebuilt his fortune and is a millionaire businessman. He's now married to his fourth wife. He got married in prison while he was serving his time for murdering his family. He got married. Shortly after his release, they divorced. Not too long after that, he got married again. Didn't last even a year. Got divorced. And now is married to his fourth wife. He lives in Florida, and his new wife knows all about the murders. He told her all about them. She even read the book. The book that I read, she read it. Together, they had a daughter, a son, and were expecting another son at the time of the edition and was written in 2018. Now, this shit sets me ablaze. This stuff gets so under my skin. His three children, or at least the two that were born at the time of writing, are named after David's dead children. Are you fucking kidding me? Are you kidding me? His daughter is named Rebecca Grace. Fuck right off. And his son's middle name is Benjamin, in remembrance of his deceased son. Y'all, ugh, I can't anymore. That shit messed me up. It makes me so angry. Ooh, all right. I'm glad that's the end of the story, because that little bit got me so heated. Deep breath. There's a newer version of the book, and the last chapter has some theories about possible suspects that came out years after David's release. I haven't looked into it. There's no proof. There's no evidence. It's just theories. And if you're interested in this, in the story and getting into the deep detail that the book goes into, I highly recommend you get the book. It was very informative and went way more in detail than I did. I just wanted to get the point across, get the story out there, tell you guys a story, the very first story that got me into true crime. And that's it, guys. Thank you for listening. Probably another kind of awkward podcast. It's a whole different vibe, like I said at the beginning, trying to record on your own. It's weird for me to try to tell a story without Katie being there to get her input, without the banter. Yeah. So I might do some more solos, and I might bring somebody in to tell them the story just to get their reaction and their banter and maybe have a little bit more fun with it. But yeah, we're back. Sorry for the month-long hiatus. All right. So guys, you can follow Voices in the Basement on Instagram at Voices in the Basement. Email us at voicesinthebasementpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow me on Instagram at _blake.andrew_. Send me an email. Let me know what you think. If you want to hear more solos, if you want me to bring somebody in to get the banter, how I could maybe get more comfortable talking to you guys, but I'm just kind of talking in the open air. Go to Apple, iTunes, subscribe, rate us, give me your comments, give me your feedback. Let me know what you want. If there's stories you want to hear, go ahead and send an email. Let me know what you want to hear. I'll do them. Go over there, rate the podcast, review us, subscribe, give me your feedback. All right, I'll talk at you guys next time. Good night. Sleep.